This being consists of essence, of a super substantiality, a changelessness. And this being exists in the innermost and the furthermost. It is diffused beyond dimension. It is called azoic, in that it has no place nor placelessness. This being then suddenly steps out of the heavens as a person and steps into the atom. And that is where the Chinese put it. That is where the Hindu put it. And that is where Buddha himself said it was, because he actually referred to the atom by name in one of his discourses. Thus we have now a power as an absolute diffused ends or quality. A power from which nothing can be either more distant or more proximate. That actually, therefore, deity is the substance from which all substances arise. Deity is substance and substantiality. Deity is not only the creator, but in his own nature and substance, the very material of creation. Therefore, God truly creates all things within his own likeness. And within this likeness, all things live and move and have their being. You can see quickly how this would shift the perspective from transcendence to immanence. For instead of deity being here or there, which was, of course, one of the great problems of Omar Khayyam, deity is always everywhere. The Hindus gradually developed the concept in relation to Brahma, who ceased to be a three- or four-headed deity seated on a lotus and became the symbol of the all-pervading presence of universal substance. Now, when we refer to substance, in this case, we do not mean matter. By substance, we mean that which is substantial or has a reality in itself. That which is not substantial is that to which a reality must be conferred. Therefore, that which is in itself, innately, the cause, the substance, the sustenance, and the power of itself may be said to be substantial. This substantiality carried with it into infinite diffusion its own essential properties. Therefore, every inconceivable or conceivable unit of energy or of substance or of essence anywhere in existence was itself triadic, consisting in its own nature of the essential completeness of the Godhead. This Godhead being the principle of being, the principle of life, and the principle of light. The ancients, and especially the Kabbalists, of course, would never leave even such words as life and light without going into the gematria and the notoricon of them. They had to go into the mystery, for to them everything was a mystery. Every example of life was mysterious in this sense, as they themselves expressed it, that mystery is the vestment of eternity. Therefore, to discover reality, we must always penetrate mystery. If we penetrate mystery, we become wise. If mystery penetrates us, we become stupid. It is a very simple principle, but a very interesting one. Therefore, we are continually seeking to penetrate mystery. And in this mystery, we are seeking substance, essence, nature, being. To this triune nature, therefore, it became appropriate to bestow the term the Ancient of Days. It became a symbol of absolute antiquity, as a solution to a problem. For to man, the problem of cause was more significant and more difficult than the problem of continuance. It would be simple to conceive of deity as ever present under this system. But it would be more difficult to use this concept to explain first cause. Therefore, in their interpretation, the Kabbalists began to explore the meanings of life, light, and being in order to answer these essential root questions. We have already more or less summarized their idea of Ein, or being, the absolute profundity, the eternity of things. Not an eternity of time alone, but an eternity of condition and an eternity of limitlessness. So that this eternity had within it at all times the roots and rudiments of an emergence or a coming forth. Thus the Pythagoreans gradually developed the concept of that of being as seminal or full of seed, like the mysterious statue of Serapis in Alexandria, the body of which was covered with growing plants. Life to these people meant the emergence of active creative processes. Things become alive when they move, when they bear fruit, when they continue. The first manifestation of life is involved with continuance. Therefore, absolute life is absolute continuance, which again relates to essence or total immortality. Life, therefore, is manifested as a continuing unfoldment of the divine nature within itself, from itself, and by means of its own power. Light to these ancient peoples carried more than the illumination of the sun or the separation between day and night. Light to them was the light of internal comprehension. Therefore, into this mystery of creatures was introduced the element of comprehension, so that these creatures could know, could be aware, could ultimately become conscious. And the end of light was that it should reveal the nature of the creating power. For the final purpose of light was that it should reveal truth. And truth in this system is nothing more than the total statement of the reality of being. Consequently, they had a very interesting and dynamic interpretation of what had once been an almost unassailed vastness of speculation. No man had dared to think of Zeus as other than an ancient bearded tyrant. But now came this new concept, the concept of the God of the Kabbalah, as appropriately represented as paternal, because of the absolute paternity of being. But this paternity now manifested through an absolute involvement in creation. In this way, it was possible to bridge the mysterious interval between God and man. It brought God and man together somewhere. And it also brought creation and creator into the power of creating, which was their common meeting place. This concept made way for mysticism as we know it. It made way for the possibility of the God experience in man. For if God dwelt in man as an essence, embodying or containing life and light, then this essential being could be, under some condition, knowable by man. Now, the problem of knowability recognized this important special phase. Namely, that to know a thing, one must be that thing which is known. And man's power to know God resides in the beingness of God in man. Man is therefore truly an expression, interpretation, revelation, not of himself, but of deity. And all things are merely deity unfolding its own eternity. We find traces of Neoplatonism here. We find traces of Buddhism, of Hinduism. We find a whole variety of ancient beliefs moving in and forming a unit within this rising Kabbalistic concept of existence. The next point, naturally, was the effort to establish a practical working definition of deity. The Kabbalists evaded this, as nearly all other mystics have, on the ground of incomprehensibility. Actually, the only power which can be aware of itself is deity. All other powers have to be essentially aware of something that is not self. Therefore, man's inability to find his own source apart from God. The individual trying to be himself achieves nothing, because this self cannot be known apart from God, due to the fact that this true self is God. This was a Buddhist point also, that the individual seeking to posit his own nature at the root of life simply desecrates the divine nature. The individual who feels that he rises from his own causes has missed the essential principle of mysticism, namely that all things have but one cause in common, and that cause is the divine nature in themselves. We see this in Vedanta, we see it in yoga, we see it rising in the disciplines of Tantra. All these schools gradually converge upon these essential principles. The next point that perhaps might concern us is this bridging from the atom, which is God, the infinite atom of infinite greatness, the infinite atom of infinite smallness, both united, however, by both the state of infinite and by the state of structure. Both are strangely atomic in their institution, in their formation. To bridge this, how is it to be crossed? The Buddhists, the Taoists, the Kabbalists all come to the same conclusion, and St. Paul speaks loudly the same thought in connection with the experience of Christ. Namely, that there is only one way in which deity can be experienced, and that is through the individual gradually retiring into the innermost sanctuary of his own life, and there gradually ceasing to be himself. And in the complete cessation of himself lies the experience of divinity. Therefore, this experience is impossible to the egotist or the egocentric individual. This was one of the strong points of Buddhism, and is one of the essential doctrines of the Kabbalah. That the only way the individual can come finally along the 49 paths that lead to the mysterious ancient is a series of renunciations, a dropping away of humanity, and a corresponding enlargement of the experience of divinity. It is a reversal of the evolutionary procedure. as we know it. It is a return to a primordial and eternal condition. Now, both East and West have their explanations for the significance of this journey. Some may say that as long as man has emerged from the divine nature, that man might as well continue to emerge and might go on and on and on to infinite individuality. Most systems have denied this, however, because this eternal continuance of self assails one of the absolute prerogatives of deity, namely that deity and deity alone is immortal. Therefore, any human being striving for immortality can attain this end legitimately only by re-identification with deity itself. A separate immortality was inconceivable both to the Kabbalists and the Buddhists. And to a measure, it was also inconceivable to the Christian of this period. It has still remained a very great question in theology. But most mystics have always assumed that the ultimate state of man has to be re-identification with deity, inasmuch as there is no other conceivable end, as all bodies must go down to the common earth, so all spirits must return to the common Father. There is no other end. This common Father, this eternal, unconditioned essence, as represented in both East and Western metaphysics, should have led and could have led to one of the most practical of all results, namely the recognition of the identity of all religious belief. But for some reason, it didn't quite get there. The reason it didn't get there, according to both systems, rests in the concept of egoism, the concept that the individual has an enduring existence of himself and is able to confer this separate survival upon his own institutions, which he has never yet quite been able to demonstrate. It is to the individualist, therefore, that the concept of a desirable individual destiny holds the greatest attraction. But to those who have studied the most abstract forms of religious idealism, are in common accord that the noblest religious concept that we have today must be, as Paul says, quoting from the Roman poet concerning the nature of God, we are his children. That it is like the parable of the prodigal son returning to his father's house, that in the end all things return to the earth or to God. Therefore, in a sense, deity becomes a symbol of earth, and earth of deity. For as earth swallows up the dead, so deity absorbs the living. There cannot be anything left suspended between these opposites and going nowhere. In the Jewish mysticism, the development of the great concept resulted also in a secondary God form. This secondary God form was called Makroprosophos, or the long face. The Makroprosophos represented the revelation of deity in the creation process. And there emerged out of the mystery of infinite being the gigantic figure, like the giant of the vision of Nebuchadnezzar, a mysterious and colossal figure with one foot upon the oceans and the other upon the land, around whose body the stars and planets moved, and whose face was always in profile, because deity was represented always with one eye. This mysterious Makroprosophos, or the long face, was the clothed God. no longer clothed as an old gentleman, even with the most ecclesiastical habiliments, but clothed in creation. God as creation. God as cosmos. As an infinite diversity of universes and solar systems. As made up of a great cluster of stars, holding in its hand the jewel of the universal cosmic galaxy. The vestments of this being were like the radiant fringe of the Milky Way, and it was surrounded by angels full of eyes, which were the stars, and its vehicle was the Merkava of Ezekiel, the chariot of righteousness. And in the midst of this great machinery of the universe sat the Ancient of the Most Ancients, the power at the root of all things, unchangeable and in its own visage unknowable. We now have Ein Sof and Ein Sofer revealed through the great face with its threefold forked beard, the hairs of the beard being the streamers of energy moving from the three powers of the deity. These are the mysterious lines of energy that are also seen moving from the heads and hands and hearts of Eastern deities. This Macroprosophos, or the long face, rises above the horizon of infinites, like a sun rising from darkness. And because this horizon of infinites resembles more than anything else a great ocean, it is represented as a mirror. And as the face rises above, the reflection of the face inverted appears in the ocean beneath. And therefore we have the two great faces, one looking down, one looking up from the shadows below. These two faces therefore represent the aspects of creation. Creation being a divine power moving, and a great natural area moved. And the spirits of Elohim moved upon the face of the waters. And the firmaments were divided. And the heaven which was above the earth was divided from the heaven which was beneath the earth. And the universe was therefore divided between the aspects of the two great faces, the one the reality and the other the illusion. For the inverted face was illusion, and the inverted face had no substance because it was reflected from the great rising visage coming over the horizon of eternity. Here are your two essential worlds of Buddhism, the world of being and the world of not being, the world of truth and the world of error. The world of divine mind and the world of mortal mind. We have the truth and the dream, with the dream merely being truth inverted. And the inverted truth becomes evil. And the inverted truth becomes the spirit of negation. And daemon est Deus inversus, God. Or rather, the devil is God upside down. This was one of the oldest of the rabbinical beliefs of the Kabbalists, that in the material world of things, everything is apparently reversed. That which is truly the highest shall appear to be the lowest, and that which appears to be the lowest shall be the highest. And that which was apparently in the beginning shall be the end. And that which was in the end, or is in the end, shall have been that which was in the beginning. Every one of these patterns strangely inverted. Inversion to the Kabbalist impelled the concept of the perversion of power. Therefore, to these people, mortal knowledge was truth upside down. To them, the wisdom of the wise was as the ignorance of God. all mortal knowledge has to be truth seen wrongly. And all divine knowledge is truth seen rightly. Thus, we have in both of these systems the concept of false value, as recognized again in the words of Christ, where he tells that those who save their lives shall lose them, and those who lose their lives in the service of truth shall gain immortal life. Everything is the reverse of the appearances of things. So Macroprosophos, the great face, has real meaning and tremendous interest to modern science. And I am told, I do not know that this is true, but it's been reported to me that Einstein was a student of the Kabbalah, and that he was profoundly impressed by the abstractions of this ancient knowledge, sensing in it, perhaps, the keys to grand values as yet comparatively unrecognized in the fields of specialized learning. The Macroprosophos, or the great face there, or represents to a measure the space we are seeking to conquer. It represents all of the greats outside spaces. For if we put all eternity together, it forms the features of a divine face gazing down upon us, or gazing at us from the infinite and the remote. Now the ancient Kabbalists devised another term, Microprosophos, or the small face. Now the little face has its relationship to man in the same measure that the great face has to the universe. The little face rises in the sunrise of the soul in the human heart. As it rises, it casts also its reflection upon the illusionary parts of man's nature. So that man, watching the sunrise of truth within his own nature, at the same time experiences the birth of error, again the inversion of the fact. And in this inversion comes also the perversion of purposes and principles. Buddha said, of course, that the primary perversion was the attempt to achieve externally in this world a degree of security that can only be attained internally. That man, therefore, seeking to perfect his outer world, was a slave of illusion, for that the primary purpose was the perfection of the inner world. Was it the intention of deity that man should perfect his outer life? Then his outer life would by its own nature be stable, which is not the case. And the individual, having given 60 or 70 or 80 years to the advancement of his physical estate, finds that nature steps in and takes him away. Therefore, it becomes uncertain that the perfection of this state is his primary project. That this represents, to a measure, the inverted face. The face of things not in themselves true, but having a likeness of truth. This likeness being the most dangerous of errors, a falseness masquerading under a reasonable or attractive guise. Thus, as the sunrise of Macroprosophos, or the great face, brought forth the mystery of the worlds, so the rising sun of Microprosophos brings forth the child from the womb, establishes the soul in man, and causes it to be appropriate, therefore, for the universe of the human body, or the composite man, to be called a microcosm, and the universe of the great face to be called a macrocosm. Terms very common in medieval thinking, but less frequently found among modern scholars. The next situation that suggests a little thinking would therefore have to do with this entrance of a mystical factor, which is to bridge the interval between God and man. In Christianity, This interval is indicated or suggested by St. Paul under the idea of the practice of charitas, or love. Love, beauty, unselfishness, all of the most noble of human emotions, were recognized as bridges by means of which man could approach the reality in his own nature. This reality was not primarily intellectual, either in the Kabbalah or in any of the other systems. This reality had to be experienced, and an experience is that of the senses or of the emotions rather than of the intellect. The mind can attain to certain distinctions, but it cannot achieve the direct experience which is reserved for what the ancients regarded as sacred love, or that love which is permitted by religion, that love which is without corruption, selfishness, or decadence within its own nature. So in this mystery of compassion or love, the ancients everywhere established their mediator between heaven and earth, between God and man. And in the Kabbalistic system, this principle is also present. And in one of the later discussions, we will go into it, but all we want to express now is the fact that in the Kabbalah, an instrument or a vehicle was set up whereby the soul of the righteous might find God. This vehicle, or the chariot of righteousness, had its grounding or its foundation in very deep metaphysical principles. In the Buddhistic system, this embodiment of love, of course, is found in the figure of Kuan Yin or Kanman, Avalokitesvara, the deity of compassion, signifying the regeneration of all passions and the fulfillment of the vow of selflessness. Other faiths also have this embodiment. Sometimes this principle is embodied as a person. Sometimes it is presented as a vehicle or a kind of means of travel, like the Chinese ship of the doctrine. But in every instance, it is made possible because of a great unselfishness, that there is some one being so perfected above other beings that it may intercede for the common good of human natures. This is, of course, also conveyed in the Maitreya concept and in the Horus concept in Egypt. It is certainly the very soul of St. Paul's interpretation of the Christ ministry, and it is found in a slightly altered form, but equally valuable, in the Kabbalistic story. Thus, deity becomes in the Kabbalah the most comprehensive aspect of God that perhaps we can conceive of. The interpretation goes on and on and on into infinite diversity, but it is a total concept, a concept in which there is no need for beginning or end, no need for the explanation of how things started or how they will be completed. All things, being in themselves infinite, unite in the nature of the sovereign infinite. And this sovereign infinite consists of the 49 paths of the Sefer Yetzirah, which it is said Moses, the beloved of God, walked the 49 paths, which were the mysterious numbers of the 7 times 7. And at the end of the 49 paths, Moses went to sleep on the mountain of Moab, and the angel of the Lord took him into the heavenly region. The Kabbalah said that there are 50 paths. Moses achieved 49 of these paths, but was not privileged to enter the promised land, the promised land being the equivalent of the Buddhist nirvana. in order that the 50th path may be achieved, there must come another who shall follow after Moses, but shall be preferred before him. And this other one, the Messiah, will be permitted to pass the 50th gate, and in so doing will open the way of salvation to all men. This is one of the elements of the Kabbalah. Now you can see how this does break through and make ground for the messianic idea, or the mysterious one who is to come. Now in Orthodox Jewry, the waiting for the Messiah continues. In the Kabbalah, I believe that the concept of this Messiah principle is innate in the entire nature of deity. In other words, the Messiah is not a separate being from God. The Messiah is the love of God added to the previous attributes, so that deity becomes being, life, light, and love. And this mysterious power of love is the mysterious hidden fourth head of Brahma, the power that is not to be seen in the beginning of things, but ripens out of the fullness of the mystery. For this love, again, is like the Merkava of righteousness. It is the power of the soul. And this power of the soul, though latent in deity, is that part of the divine mystery which must be completed by the creature and not by the creator. Therefore, in the process of unfolding life, in the process of growth, man experiences the rise of a new relationship with life. And as he matures, love is born as a soul in him. And it is this soul power in him which will ultimately be his Savior. And it is present in deity, or it could not be born in man. But its birth in man is a voluntary act. And the cultivation of this power is where determinism comes into what would otherwise appear to be a locked cycle of God's will. This determinism being the fact that man has the power, or will develop the power, to fashion from his own nature the very bridge upon which he must cross in order to reach the other shore of truth. The power of this bridge is the seed in him. It has always been present. But whereas nature will perfect his body and reason will perfect his mind, only man's own internal dedication will perfect the bridge by means of which he crosses from one state to another. This is the ship of the doctrine that is formed from the body of the holy Bodhisattva. This is also the nave of the church, for the ancients regarded the ecclesia, or the church, as the ship of this salvation. And they therefore regarded it as the symbol of concord, a design set up by God to carry all souls to their ultimate reunion with deity. In this, then, the soul of man becomes something that is called the immortal mortal. It becomes like the hero gods of the ancient times. For this soul is something that has a birth in time, but a continuance in eternity. This is the only thing which is born but does not die. There is a belief, of course, that in a mysterious way it does die. But the soul power of it does endure and does continue. The identification by the Christian Kabbalists of the soul principle with the crucifixion of Christ is, I think, also worth noting. Because in this case, Christ, representing the power of the soul, does die for the sin of the world. but is restored or resurrected in due time. This concept of soul, therefore, forming a bridge, permits another aspect to arise, namely the shadow bridge, or the bridge of the inverted face. For the soul, if perverted, becomes the angel of self-destruction. And the perverted soul becomes the bridge to Gehenna, the symbol of the bridge to limbo or destruction. Thus, upon our affections or our loves, according to the ancient peoples, we build the power to conceive the nature of God. And that which does not love cannot know God. And that which does not love its fellow man which it hath seen, how can it love its Father in heaven whom it hath not seen? So to the ancients, regenerated affection, represented by the vow of Amitabha, the unselfish dedication of the human being to the service of others because of a great love for God and man, this becomes the bridge of salvation. The Kabbalah is very explicit on this point. It tells us very definitely of this machinery, and that therefore man is building the bridge of immortality by the unfoldment of his own natural dedications, that he cannot think himself to the other shore. He can only experience himself there by self-forgetfulness, by the dedication of life to the service of life. He moves triumphantly upon this mystery. For it is said in China that when the great sage Daruma, or Bodhidharma, patriarch of Zen, resolved to visit China, he stepped out upon the leaf of a plant, and in meditation upon the needs of China, he was carried upon this leaf across the sea, so that he was described as the sea-walking Brahman. And when he came out of his meditation, he found himself in China, having crossed the waters without a ship. And this was because in his meditation, he had asked that his life could be devoted to the unselfish purpose of making possible the improvement of the spiritual understanding of the Chinese and the instruction of these people in the mysteries of the true doctrine. As a reward for that, he was carried untroubled across the ocean. This is the same concept. In the idea of love, man crossed the ocean interval that divides this shore from the other shore, the mysterious river we all must cross in the old Christian hymn. So in the Kabbalah, this growing, unfolding soul power of man becomes the mysterious Merkava of righteousness. It is therefore the dedicated conduct of the person that forms within itself the immortal mortal. And it is this immortal mortal that guides the traveler through the mysterious underworld of the mysteries of Greece and Rome to the final presence of the Hierophant, the Lord of the Mysteries. It is the same concept again as the figure standing in the midst of the candlesticks of Revelation. And the entire symbolism of Revelation has to do with this mysterious journey from worldliness to godliness, across the mysterious ocean of doubts. It is another wandering in the mystery lands of Dante's Inferno, the journey from ignorance to truth, carried or led by Virgil. And in this case, Virgil representing the human soul. For Virgil was the poet, not the philosopher. He was the mystic, not the intellectual. And the muse of great poetry, the mysterious winged horse Pegasus, was the one that carried the souls of the illustrious into the wonderful worlds beyond in the old legendary and lore. And the poet, the way of the poet, was represented as the way of the heart doctrine. So the heart doctrine is found in all of these philosophies and principles. And it is by means of the heart doctrine that the child returns to the parent, and man comes again into the mysterious experience of the presence of the Great One, whose face is veiled with 10,000 veils, as it was seen by Moses upon the blazing crest of the mountain. All of these principles were involved in Kabbalistic speculation, and I think they have considerable meaning to us right now, and we hope you'll think so too as we go on with this next week. Thank you very much.